We live in a day where the idea of the irrelevance of religion and even the danger of religion is being propagated all over again. Okay, this is something that you'll hear around the traps. The idea, and above all other criticisms, is this idea, and it's always interesting to me, is that Jesus comes under almost the highest assault. It's very interesting when you look at it on a world stage. Jesus is at best referred to as irrelevant to our modern world and modern ways of thinking, and at worst is simply a myth and a created religious icon so religious authorities can wield power and control, end quote. This is a declaration of the irrelevance of religion, but almost at the head of the hit list is the irrelevance of Christ. People look at the Bible as an irrelevant mythological text, choosing to ignore its accuracy across many fields of study. Now, I told you last week, and it got a little bit of a ooh, that I'm not going to use the Bible to speak into this topic, and I intend not to. Because this is what we're often told. You only have the Bible to stand on. You've got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and this account of Acts. That's the only influence of Jesus. And, you know, we're told that's it. And so you stand on these texts that are written by nobodies. They're mythological texts. They're not legitimate. So I'm willingly putting them all away this morning. Let's just brush them aside and see where we end up. James Hall, welcome back. James is back from Darwin. Sorry, I didn't see you before. So good to have you here. James is Helen's husband, and their family is spread across the country, but stoked to have you here. Anyway, this study this morning, and it is a study, it is a teaching. You're going to have to choose to engage it, is to simply look at the external, extra-biblical evidence that gives us the veracity or the authenticity of some of the elements of this text. The reality is you still have to wrestle with what it says. Okay? You still have to wrestle with what it says, but this is an amazing starting point. So as we enter into this series, The Game Changer, this is like a welcome mat. This is just a mat that I'm putting out that says, geez, this is so worth exploring. This is not just religious dogma. This is historical text and context that we're looking at. And so this morning, it's just a short, in no way exhaustive look at the historicity of Christ, the historical accuracy and presence of Jesus, who was called the Christ. So the question is, what is his record outside the biblical text? What is the evidence for Jesus outside of the biblical text? What influence did Jesus actually have? Now, 30 years ago, and I'm going to close this morning with a song. And this song was something that when I was a young teenager, I heard this song and it triggered a series of questions in me that said, who was Jesus? Because there's all sorts of opinions about him, but who was he? What is said about him? And it was a turning point for me. So to start with, let me just say this. It's fascinating to me that there is actually any extra-biblical reference to Jesus Christ. I think, why would there be? Because when you look at the biblical account, and I'm just going to touch on some points without opening it, because you really look at it and go, why the heck would there? Why would anyone have written about him? Why? Because he's a man who is born in complete obscurity. The account, if you look at it, although we, you know, present it with choirs and of angels and everything else, it was this kid born in obscurity to very questionable parents and beginnings and a very questionable heritage. He's raised by a carpenter, as a carpenter, like any other boy in any other village of that day. And there aren't any accounts of the life of a tradie from that time period. They just don't exist. He began to teach at 30 years old. He was an itinerant teacher, one of many, around the hills and towns of Judea, apparently not from any great theological school, nor taught the scriptures by scribes or the schools of the Pharisees, as was the acclamation of any teacher in any standing of that time period. Jesus has none of it. He has a relatively small devoted following and was the object of inquiry by crowds. Many of those who followed him were actually of ill repute themselves. You've got other tradies, you've got deceivers, you've got women of questionable character of the day. So he's despised by the religious authorities. He is followed around, ridiculed. Some think he is completely mad. The entire length of his preaching career was about 3 years. He's put to death as a criminal, one of many of the day in a common practice and form of the day, witnessed by only a few who cared to be present. He never owned a home, never had social status, never built a synagogue nor a monument after his name, never wrote a book. Why would there be any reference to this person? You have to logically ask yourself the question. Contextually, he is virtually a nobody. So you have to stop and go, so why is there so much reference and pushback against who he is? It's truly, if you went to any other socially insignificant individual of the time period, they just drift into history and obscurity. So let's look at what can be gleaned from the places that he is mentioned outside of the biblical account. Now, I'm going to say this. There are a number of things I have deliberately left out. All right? I have left out, and some people that would do research would say, oh, you've got to include Josephus. Josephus was a Jewish historian who did make reference to Jesus, but I have chosen to completely leave him out of the text. High school students, youth, Josephus, the name may not mean anything to you, but he is recognized as an incredible historian, but I am choosing to leave him out. Why? Because it is evidence that some of his writings were tampered with best of intention by early Christians who added in references to him as Messiah, which a Jewish historian who was not a follower of Jesus would not have included. So there is evidence of tampering. So for integrity's sake, I just have removed Josephus from anything I'm going to say. All right? Another one is what's called many of the Gnostic writings. A lot of the Gnostic writings are what are called pseudo-Christian writers. They write masses of stuff about Jesus and historically reported things about Jesus, but they have all these sort of secret knowledge attachments to them. But a lot of skeptics will say, well, Gnostics are just expanded Christian writers, so they're just another Christian group. So I've written off the Gnostics as well. All right, no Josephus in what I'm saying, none of the Gnostic writings in what I'm saying, and what do we have left? Okay, so here we go. Let's start with a fella named Lucian of Samosata. Now, it's interesting to look at the time periods they write because they are time periods that a lot of Paul's letters are being written in. They are times when the Gospels are finally being put down on paper. And so these are writers who are of the same period, right? Looking at Lucian there, 125 to after 180 AD. He's a Syrian satirist who is best known for his characteristic tongue-in-cheek style, which is, he frequently ridicules superstition, religious practices, and belief in the paranormal. So Lucian is not an advocate of the Christian faith. In fact, he is quite cynical about it and satirizes it along with so many other areas. So Lucian writes many works, some of which still exist today, and amongst those, one called this, The Death of Pellegrine, or The Passing of Peregrinus. It is a satire in which the lead character, the cynic philosopher Peregrinus Proteus, takes advantage of generous Christians. So that contextualizes this writing for you. What does Lucian say? Here's some excerpts from paragraphs 11 and 13. Now, what I'm going to tell you before I really read these is this. There's a lot of people who write and then make reference to these documents. I'm not content with that. That to me becomes hearsay. If I'm quoting someone who said, someone said, someone said. So what I've done in preparation for this is I have trolled the internet finding the original copies of documents. Okay, so what I have done is I've actually gone back to what is reported to be accurate translation of these documents. Again, they are not supportive of the Christian faith. These are just statements written in this time period. So Lucian, paragraphs 11 and 13, says these three things that I pull out. It was now that he, being Pellegrine, came across the priests and scribes of the Christians in Palestine and picked up their queer creed. The Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. Last one there. These deluded creatures, you see, have persuaded themselves that they are immortal and will live forever, which explains the contempt of death and willing self-sacrifice so common amongst them. It was impressed on them, too, by their lawgiver that from the moment they are converted, they deny the gods of Greece, they worship the crucified sage and live after his laws. They're all brothers. They take his instructions completely on faith, with the result that they despise all worldly goods and hold them in common ownership. So, and I like this last line, so an adroit, unscrupulous fellow who knows the world has only to get amongst these simple souls and his fortune is quickly made, for he plays with them. So that's his take on Christians. And this is written from a completely, as you can probably read in the, you know, the tone of it, this whole satirical mindset of what Christians are like. But what do you see in that? Does anything stand out to anyone? And this is not a rhetorical question. This is an invitation to engagement. What things do you see in that as statements? Right. They worship a man. And that man was a man who was crucified, right? Not, this is not Christian, and this is not written in an advocation of Christian scriptures. What else do you see in there? It's what? Where do you see eternity? Yeah, the immortality. There is this hope of eternity that comes in for these people who believe. They all believe they become what? Brothers and sisters. What else do you see in there? Right from back then, it was known that it was by faith. Fascinating things that you just see, and these are all written in the critique. Let's go on to the next one, Tacitus. In full, his name is Gaius Cornelius Tacitus. Again, time period, AD 56 to circa 120. Roman orator and public official, probably the greatest historian, one of the greatest prose stylists who wrote in the Latin language. Amongst his works is one called the Annals, dealing with the Roman Empire period from AD 14 to 68. This is taken from book 15, paragraph 44. If you go on to that next slide, you'll see this. Consequently, and this is written in context of the fires of Rome that were attributed post that time period to Nero. If you know Roman history, you'll be aware of that, but that sets the tone. So consequently, it is written by Tacitus, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations. They're called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Another translation says prefectures, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition thus checked for the moment again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. This is Tacitus, a Roman historian, in reference to the fires of Rome that were blamed on who? On who? Christians. Christians exist and are acknowledged in Rome. The founder of the Christian faith is referenced as Christus, Christ. What else do you see in there? Yeah, Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. These are extra or outside gospel accounts that confirm what gospel writers also write, but we're not referencing gospel writers. It's fascinating. Where did it break out? Judea. And where did it go to? Rome. You follow the book of the Gospels, the book of Acts, from Judea to Rome. The whole thing, just the Roman historian follows the same thing. You go from Tacitus to Pliny the Younger. Again, time period 61 to 113, Roman author and administrator, collection of letters that offer intimate glimpses into public and private life during the Roman Empire. His writings are preserved in 10 books. First nine, which I did not read, contain 247 personal letters. The 10th is his official correspondence, back and forward, both Trajan's writings and his writings, back and forward for the whole book. Letters contain best source available of political and social history of Rome for the time period that they cover. In Book 10, Letter 96, here is this reference to how should you deal with Christians who are on trial for their faith. Okay, so this is what the letter contextually is being written back and forward between Pliny and Trajan. Trajan responds to this question from Pliny. They affirmed the whole of their guilt or their error was that they met on a stated day before it was light. They addressed a form of prayer to Christ as to a divinity, binding themselves by a solemn oath, not for the purposes of any wicked design, but never to commit any fraud, theft, adultery, never to falsify their word, nor deny a trust when they should be called on to deliver up, after which was their custom to separate and then reassemble to eat in common a harmless meal. So what Pliny is saying in the question here is, look, Christians are arrested and the ones that confess to a crime will only confess to this. And Pliny is just frustrated. He's like, what do I do? And it's interesting, I haven't got it here, but Trajan responds and he says, look, don't worry. If they'll recant all that, great. Don't make a big deal out of it. But the problem is they won't recant it. But what's the issue? Have a look at what things you pick out there. What's their practice? They meet together on one day of the week. Well, you can find that in the New Testament. What else do they do? They sing. They say a prayer to Christ as if he is what? God. So even outside this, Roman historians are saying, man, they fully believe Christ is their God. They bind themselves to a solemn oath, but even their solemn oath doesn't seem to have any wicked design to it. What do they do? They just commit themselves to pretty much obeying the Ten Commandments, like doing what God said to do. And then what do? They eat. This is such a good day to do it as we have Sunday table together, because we are simply doing what has been done for nearly 2,000 years. So this is the same accusation from Pliny in dealing with Christians. Then there's this fourth one, and here's the last of the four, and this one, and I just could get lost in. This fella is a fella named Celsus. Now, Celsus is a second century Greek writer who is a fierce critic of Christianity. Celsus makes lots of references to the Christian faith and to the worship of Jesus. And he attacks what are by the second century firmly established Christian beliefs and doctrines. Now, Celsus's writings no longer exist. They have disappeared. But where you find Celsus's writings are here. If we flip over that picture, there is this work that was done by this fella named Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N, of Alexandria. And he writes a response to this writing of Celsus, which was called Divine Truth or True Word. So what we have is Origen of Alexandria's response to Celsus's writings. But what they've looked at is they reckon that Origen has quoted, and he directly quotes Celsus and then responds to it. So they believe that he's responded to 60 to 80% of what Celsus wrote. So it's recognized that Celsus's writings still exist, but they're within the context of Origen's writings. Hope that's not too confusing. But he's a prolific writer, circa 184 to 253. This is Origen. And he is described as one of the greatest geniuses the early church ever produced. I went and I found his works. It is enormous. His Counter Celsus work, which will come up on this next one, Contra Celsus, is huge. If you want to read volumes of it, read it. It's very interesting, the arguments that he defends. But this goes back to second century, and they believe that Celsus really just argues and attacks and criticizes the Christian faith. Why? And please, I hope I'm not losing you back there. It feels like we're far away, but lean in. This whole thing that Celsus writes is really believed to be out of his deep love for Rome. Rome is beginning to fall into disrepair. And Christians have been accused as being the ones who are undermining Roman society because of their simple practices as addressed by Pliny. But what happens, look at some of these statements that Celsus makes as quoted by Origen. All right? Some charges are as such. And this is writing that Celsus says, and he puts himself in the position of this discussion, but here he is. He accuses him of having invented his birth from a virgin and upbraids him for being born in a certain Jewish village of a poor woman of that country who gained her subsistence by spinning, who was turned out of doors by her husband, a carpenter by trade, because she was convicted of adultery, and after that being driven away by her husband, wandering about for a time, she disgracefully gave birth to Jesus, an illegitimate child, who, having hired himself out as a servant in Egypt on account of his poverty, having there acquired some miraculous powers on which the Egyptians greatly pride themselves, returned to his own country, highly elated on account of them, and by means of these proclaimed himself a god. Now, this is a really aggressive attack, and you can sense it in just the wording, but he goes after what he thinks is the ridiculous claims of Jesus, and there were other stories going around to undermine what gospel writers had written. But what do you see? In fact, let me just skip on to the next one. This is from book 6 and chapter 73. That tells you how much there is. But look at this. I've highlighted in blue. Celsus adds the following. If God had wished to send down his spirit from himself, what need was there to breathe it into the womb of a woman? For as one who knew already how to form men, he could also have fashioned a body for this person without casting his own spirit into so much pollution. And in this way, he could not have been received with incredulity if he had derived his existence immediately from above. Fascinating. What things do you see in just those two things from the quotes of Celsus? Jesus was said to be of virgin birth. Son of a carpenter. That he did miraculous signs. Like you start going through those and just find the things that are in there again. And I forgot to screenshot this one. But on the worship of Jesus, Celsus is quoted as writing this. Now, if the Christians worshipped only one God, they might have reason on their side. But as a matter of fact, they worship a man who appeared only recently, and their worship of this Jesus is more outrageous because they refuse to listen to any talk about God, the Father of all, unless it includes some reference to Jesus. And when they call him the Son of God, they're not really paying homage to God. Rather, they're attempting to exalt Jesus to the heights. And this is his arguments against Christianity, but what it affirms are the claims and the tenets of the Christian faith. I hope I'm not getting you bogged down in this. These are statements that are completely outside the Bible. And then at the end of this, Celsus is quoted as writing on the spread of the Christian faith. Quoted again by Origen, yet Celsus himself admits that it is not the simple alone who were led by the doctrine of Jesus to adopt his religion. He acknowledges that there were amongst them some persons of moderate intelligence, gentle disposition, and possessed of understanding and capable of comprehending allegories, illustrations, parables. Fascinating, because Celsus originally says, man, they're just going after the underclass that don't even have the ability to comprehend, but comes back later and says, uh-oh, it's spreading. It's spreading to people who actually are people of knowledge and understanding and can get what is being said. And this is just part of Celsus's fear. So what do we gain from reading the arguments that Celsus even brings? So you look at these four, you've got Lucian, you've got Tacitus, you've got Pliny, you've got Celsus through Origen here, and you begin to have to say, wow, there is a lot of things written back then that actually seem to concur or line up with what the New Testament might have said. And this is simply to demonstrate that the historical account of the person of Jesus. Celsus, amongst others, might have had his opinions about Christian theology, but one thing that is interesting is never once do these writers question the existence of Jesus. They're writing in his time period. You won't find in these places that they question his existence. They just attack what he said, who he was reported to be. So it's interesting, there's no debate in the ancient world, neither with the Jewish rabbis nor the Gnostic writers that I left out of this, not amongst the pagan writers, not amongst the Roman historians. Any doubt in their mind that he was a figure of history, they are writing in the same time period. Each reference actually in these seems to corroborate the ones I've brought out of that, the historical details of Jesus. In fact, outside of the Gospels, here's what you see. Jesus was a Jew. He was supposedly born of a virgin. His father was a carpenter. He was a teacher who taught repentance and faith. He was a wise man who said he was God and was believed to be the Messiah. He had unusual powers and did miraculous deeds. He was arrested, tried, crucified under Pontius Pilate during the reign of Tiberius. He was said to be resurrected. His followers held a high moral code. They met regularly, and his followers became brothers and sisters. They worshipped Jesus, asked God, and his message spread. There's a summation of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. Completely outside of those books. People want to deny him. They want to explain him away. They want to remove his deity or remove his influence, because if And this is the capital I, capital F that we have to wrestle with. If Jesus was who he said he was, then we've got some reckoning to do. And that's why I believe people want to erase Jesus. Because if he was who he said he was, then you've got to deal with it. So we're left with this question, and I think it's most beautifully said in a writing by C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity. C.S. Lewis says this: I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level of the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him, you can kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that option open to us. He did not intend to. And this is why I say this is your welcome mat to Jesus the Game Changer, because the reality is that the historical existent person of Jesus turned the known world on its head. In all accounts and all the criticisms, Jesus should be a nobody that, even as written in the book of Acts, should have drifted into insignificance and back into the obscurity that he came from. But he didn't. And this is where we, in turn, have to wrestle. Young people, and I say this, you know, under 20 years old who are here this morning, you're in the hotbed of this wrestle. Because, you know, Jesus did not come to create a new religion. He actually, in his words, came to set us free from religion. But we sort of throw him in the whole, you know, soup bowl of everything, and out it goes. Jesus cannot be just a good moral teacher, as C.S. Lewis said. I had this conversation this week with someone I really value their relationship. But they said that I'm okay with Jesus being like on par as a good teacher with Buddha and any of the others, but I don't believe he was God. And I'm like, well, here's the problem. Because he's either in the waste bin or he's who he said he is, because he lied. If he's not who he said he is, he's a liar. And a liar is not a good guy and not a good teacher and not even worth thinking on anything else if he is a chronic liar. So then you're left going, oh, what do I do with that? And so one of the encouragements in the Bible is guard your heart above all things, because it's the wellspring of life. I would encourage you, if you're exploring your faith, know why you believe. And I remember the question from this song when I was young, because it's this song that just really wonderfully describes a lot of what these accounts of Jesus were. I remember hearing it. And I was raised in a home that I knew the name of Jesus and I knew the Christian faith. But this song just sort of puts some characteristics to the person that I knew I needed to answer. And about 30 years ago, I made a decision. I am a thinker. I am going to be like a dog on a bone and do the research that I can to get to the bottom of stuff. And I'm stoked to have access that we do on the internet these days for the good things that are out there. But this question remains probably for a lot of us to wrestle with. And this is that song.